Our next matter is County Hennepin versus Tamara L. Lackalt, respondent. Our file is A190473, and so counsel, you can make yourself comfortable as best as that's possible. And as counsel is aware, each party will have 15 minutes to present their argument, respond to questions. Appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. We do ask that you identify yourself for our record when you do approach the podium. And as soon as appellant's ready to proceed, you may.
Your Honor, good morning. My name is Rick Sheridan. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I represent the appellant, County of Hennepin, in this matter. May it please the court, the appellant is here today to ask this court to reverse a decision of the district court that denied the county's motion for new trial, which was based on our motion in limine to exclude certain construction-related interference evidence from the trial. This is not a complicated case. What the county is asking for here is this court to apply law that really is not in dispute by either party. As you read through the materials, I don't believe some of the law that applies is really in dispute. For example, in an eminent domain case, we know that just compensation requires that the date of taking is the date that just compensation is determined. So under the constitutional standard of just compensation, the date of taking is the date those damages are calculated. We know that in the ANDA decision, ANDA says in a quick take case, which this case is a quick take case, that the date of valuation is the date of the quick take. It's actually the date title and possession transfers, which typically is the quick take date, which in this case was November 13th of 2015. We also know that there is a significant case law in Minnesota that says that evidence in an eminent domain matter must be competent, material, and relevant. I don't think that is in dispute. I don't think either side would dispute that. And we also have the Elmore case, which talks about, although Elmore was a standard, not a quick take case, stands for the rule that evidence that is not known on the date of valuation is not admissible. And so our argument is simple, is that you have construction activity, you have construction-related activity, you have construction interference evidence that is brought into these trials. All that happens after the date of valuation and therefore should not be admitted.
Can I ask you, Mr. Sheridan, you started out by saying the agreement, although it seems like and maybe you haven't quite got to the large disagreement perhaps, but didn't the Strom case pretty much settle the issue of whether post-taking construction-related interference is relevant as a factor in the valuation? And assuming that to be so, isn't there an exclusion in terms of a trial judge? That's a big distinction. You would still have to have, adequate expert advice to give that and so forth, but to exclude it in limine seems to be a decision to disagree with Strom. In other words, you can't even present that evidence to the jury.
That's
wasn't
correct,
that what the judge was faced with here on an motion in limine versus was there foundation and adequate compliance with the rules of evidence once that is presented to the jury?
Right. I agree with you, Your Honor. I think the big disagreement here is the application of Strom. I believe that is what is really the central argument here. And there's no question that the district court relied on Strom in denying her motion. In her decision, the judge went through the various case law and then got to Strom and said Strom requires this. Strom is not controlling because Strom considered construction-related interference that occurred before the date of valuation. So you had the quick take date, you had the construction activity happen, you had the stipulated facts in Strom of the lower rental and the higher vacancy building. That all happened during the construction. That was stipulated to by the parties. And then you had the commission hearing, and then the commission award was filed. And so all this evidence took place prior to the date of valuation, because as we've pointed out in our materials during the Strom decision, the decisional law in Minnesota was that the date of valuation was still the date the commission award was filed. And so Strom would stand for that proposition, that if you had pre-date evaluation evidence of construction interference, it could be considered as a factor. But ANDA then came along, overruled Holt, which was a published decision that was in existence at the time of Strom, had been decided, and said, no, in a quick take case, the date of valuation is the date of the quick take. And so now the evidence that was stipulated to in Strom, all this evidence of the lost rent, the lower rents, the higher vacancy rate, et cetera, that now would become, under ANDA, would have happened after the date of valuation. It would not have been known on the date of valuation. That would have been pure speculation to say that this is what's going to happen.
Didn't the ANDA court reiterate Strom, in other words, included Strom in its opinion, didn't make any reference to overruling Strom in that case?
Right, it didn't.
There's no case that has said Strom was wrong, and hence, at least from the Supreme Court, and we won't do that, of course, or shouldn't do that.
No, right.
And so my question perhaps that goes, is there a distinction between relevant evidence of a loss to a landowner versus the timing of the evaluation? And the reason I'm asking that is, isn't there many areas of the law in which we value property, which would include, could include prospective evidence that's reasonable and has foundational basis, expert, so forth, as to what that loss might be?
Well, if I understand your question correctly, Your Honor, other than eminent domain, I haven't researched other areas of the law in terms of whether prospective evidence beyond what would be an identified date of valuation is admissible. So I can't answer that question as to other areas of the law. I believe that the eminent domain law is clear, that if it's after the date of valuation, it just is not admissible. It has to be, and that's what Elmore stands for, and ANDA, to a certain extent, when they decided the contamination issue, also concluded that it had to be known, the contamination had to be known on the date as of the date, or not, it had to exist, excuse me, it had to exist as of the date of valuation, even if it was discovered later. So the date of valuation has always been a key date in valuing, in the admissibility of evidence in an eminent domain case. And I think if you look at the ANDA case, the threshold issue was this question of what is the date of valuation. They had to decide that issue before they got to the issue of whether the contamination evidence was going to come in. And the reason
can
they
I
did
ask
that
maybe
is
just a slightly different way. In other words, on the date of valuation, if we know there will be a potential of post-construction interference and it hasn't yet occurred, that would not mean, I presume, as a matter of law, that it's not admissible. It means we just don't know today what that is, and so that there would have to be a testimony and evidence that would present that.
I disagree with you. I believe that the law is that if it is not known on the date of valuation, then it's not admissible.
But the case law allows for if it's knowable, if it's discovered later, but reasonably foreseeable, knowable, could have been known to a potential buyer, hypothetical seller, then that might be admissible.
I think, Your Honor, I think it would depend on what that evidence is. But yes, under the law, if it's reasonably ascertainable, reasonably knowable, it would be admissible. The problem in this case is that the owners themselves have said that, well, we have to wait till all the construction's done before we can know what the evidence is. And so by their own admission, it's not reasonably knowable on the date of valuation, because if it was, they would present that evidence.
Right. I guess I'm kind of stuck a little bit with the procedural setting. It's a little bit of a hiccup for me that the motion that we're dealing with is, or the decision we're dealing with is the district court's ruling on a motion in limine. Was the motion to exclude the evidence remade? Was the objection presented again during the trial so that we're not just considering, I mean, we're trying to decide whether the district court abuses discretion in making a decision early on to exclude all of the evidence. And I'm wondering if there's a possibility that some of the evidence might have been relevant, and you can't know that until the case develops, at which point an objection can be made and the district court can rule on it once it's clear.
Let me try and answer that two ways. First of all, I want to take a step back and talk about what type of evidence we're talking about first. I think that's helpful. So what you have happen in these hearings, what is presented generally in construction-related interference, is you'll have the owner come in and testify about things that happened during the construction. You know, the construction, there was noise, there was vibration, they're on my property, they're doing, these things. And you'll have the appraiser, and they'll show pictures. They'll take pictures of, you know, equipment on their property or around their property doing work. And then the appraiser will have the same type of evidence. They'll have gone out to the project. They'll have taken pictures of construction activity that's going on, and they'll then incorporate that into their appraisal about how it works. So that's the evidence we're talking about. Back to your question about whether a motion was made at the hearing to object to this, no, it was not. And this court and the Supreme Court recently decided a case from our office called BACTA, where in that matter, the issue was whether or not if you made a motion in limine that had been fully briefed at the district court level, did you have to preserve that in a motion for a new trial to have the appeal, to preserve your appeal, and the Supreme Court said that no, you did not.
No, I'm not suggesting that there's any lack of preservation of the issue. Okay. I'm trying to consider the perspective from which we're reviewing the district court's decision. If the district court is asked at the outset, judge, exclude all evidence in this field, a district court judge might say, I would suppose, well, at this point in a motion in limine, I don't know exactly how all of this evidence fits, so I'm going to deny the motion. Now, if you raise an objection later on, when it becomes clear from the evidence that the particulars of the objection are objectionable, that the evidence should be excluded, then it seems we're looking at it from a more tightly restricted review perspective. Do you understand what
I do? And I would, my answer to that would be that, first of all, we did specifically ask the judge to exclude post-date evaluation evidence. Therefore, had there been some type of pre-date evaluation evidence, that could have come in. We were not. So going back to your original question about the reasonable, knowledge of if you had something that was reasonably knowable, we were not objecting to that, and that was not part of our motion in limine. And it's our position that there is a bright line at the date of evaluation. That if it doesn't known as of the date of evaluation, it's not admissible. And the Elmore case really speaks to that.
But doesn't case law suggest that there are circumstances where evidence that is discovered after the date of evaluation, or circumstances that are discovered after the date of evaluation, might in fact bear upon whether a reasonable buyer and seller would have foreseen that circumstance?
I'm not aware of that case law. I'm not. I've researched this, and I'm not aware of case law that talks about after post-date evaluation discovered evidence that is admissible.
Can I ask, Mr. Sherry, that seems to be your focus, is the post-date evaluation. But it seems like the trial court correctly looked at this quote from the Strom case in answering the question in the affirmative. And that is any partial taking case, which we have here, evidence of construction-related interference is admissible as a separate item of damages, but as a factor, for the finder of fact to consider. That, in a sense, is what, if I understand the position the county is taking, did at the motion in limine, and why there wasn't a separate motion, that even if there's foundation, even if there is prospectively, as a matter of law, at the date of the taking / possession on a quick take, even if we would all concede as a matter of fact and law that there is such a thing as post-construction interference that affects a buyer and seller, it ought not to be admissible. And did I say that correctly?
Well, I think you did. But I mean, our position is that I appreciate and understand what Strom says about the evidence in a quick take case. Our position is that it is distinguishable because that was evidence that was pre-date evaluation at the time, And this evidence, because of ANDA, is now post-date evaluation. Therefore, ANDA's not Strom is not controlling on that. So I appreciate what it says, but it's not controlling because it's a different legal framework that we're in now. And as I pointed out in my materials and in the graphic that I gave, the Holt decision was essentially the framework, the legal framework of the Strom decision, and that was overruled by ANDA.
Can I ask then, how would that square then with the overriding that all these cases, including ANDA, keep going back to is full compensation for a buyer? And Strom did, ANDA did, and really all these cases in between keep talking about the same constitutional. So unless there's a dispute of the existence of a post-construction, and that would be cross-examination and competing experts, how would this court reach that conclusion from these cases, absent some direct distinction of that point you just made?
No, I really believe, and you said that the focus is on the date evaluation, and that is the focus. And I believe that's the focus because that's what the law says. If you look at the case law, the date evaluation is the critical date for the admissibility of evidence. And ANDA has changed the circumstances of Strom and made Strom not controlling on this. That's our position. And so the results don't drive admissibility of evidence. The desired result doesn't drive the admissibility of evidence. So we don't say just because we think the landowner should be paid for something, we're going to let certain things in. And so I don't think you can approach it from, we all may think that construction interference is something that might affect value, but there are many items of that affect value that are not admissible in eminent domain cases. And so you think it's something that should be compensated for, if you can't prove it and the evidence shouldn't come in because that's what the law says, that's what the effect is.
Thank you, Counsel.
I apologize for going past that. I follow up to Judge Ross's standard of review from a little different perspective. You're appealing the denial of a motion for a new trial.
That's correct.
And you're claiming that the district court let in evidence that shouldn't have come in.
That's correct.
Assuming you are correct, is that enough for you to prevail? I mean, it's not enough. We get cases all the time where evidence is admitted. And in this case, the judge specifically said, I don't think that evidence affected the jury. And no, our standard is abuse of discretion to review the district court that sat through that trial.
That's right. And I appreciate that question, Your Honor. I think that I've tried to answer that in the materials as to what the various awards of damages were by the jury and what was claimed by each party, what each party's assessment of the damages were. And I don't believe there's any way to exclude the construction-related interference as part of the severance damages that were awarded by the jury. And so the second, the part of the standard of review that it had to affect the jury's verdict, we believe it did.
Well, the district court said the jury could well have concluded, based on the evidence presented by the county, that respondent's property sustained severance damages in the amount they awarded.
Right, but respectfully to the district court judge, she had no basis for making that statement. I mean, I understand she sat at the trial, and I appreciate that, but there's no other basis for that statement that she made. And if you look at in my materials, I tried to articulate this, that even if you accept that the jury took the county's position at whole, that would have been about $13,000 worth of severance damages, and the jury awarded $25,390,000. So they had to get the extra money from somewhere, and that had to come from the respondent, the landowner's claim, and easily could have been some of that, or all of it could have been construction-related interference.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel respondent, you may approach.
Thank you, Your Honors. If it pleases the court, my name is John Morphew from Morphew Law Office, appearing today on behalf of the respondent in this matter, Tamara Lackolt. Before I get to the issue of the admissibility of evidence on construction-related interference that occurred after the date of taking, I do want to start kind of getting back to Judge Kalatowski's question regarding the applicable standard of review and abuse of discretion in this case, because I think this case can easily be addressed on that level alone. And as we know, in order to overrule the district court's denial of the county's post-trial motion for a new trial, this court has to conclude that the district court abused its discretion in allowing evidence of construction-related interference that occurred after the date of taking. So we know that burden of proof is extremely high, and that the county has to prove that there was a reasonable likelihood that evidence affected the jury's verdict. you look at the county's brief, it concedes that there's no breakdown of the damages that were awarded by the jury. All we know is the gross number of the award of damages, that, or the jury's verdict in awarding damages to the property owner in this case. We don't know on what basis or how they reached their decision. We just know that that's the amount. And their entire appeal is based upon the theory that, quote, it is entirely possible that some or all of the award included construction-related interference damages.
I thought their argument was that it's necessary that that's the conclusion, given that the jury made a gross award of severance damages and that that award exceeded the amount claimed by the respondent for construction-related interference.
It's true that that was more than what was in the in respondent's appraisal, but we're talking just a mere few hundred dollars between the two, between the appraisal and the award of damages on the issue of severance damages. But regardless of that, Minnesota Statute 117.175 Subdivision 1 in the condemnation statute states that an appeal of a commissioner's award, the quote, jury shall reassess the damages de novo and apportion the same as evidence and justice may require. That grants the jury to fashion its own award of damages as the evidence and the interests of justice allow. It doesn't necessarily have to be based upon the testimony, the appraisals of the experts. The jury can come to their own conclusion. And if you look at our brief, there was a lot of testimony from both my client and from the county's appraiser about how this taking impacted her property beyond just construction-related interference. There was a lot of testimony and pictures and evidence submitted regarding the damage that it did to her backyard. Remember, she had a custom landscape backyard. The pictures show that. You know, we're talking a complete sound and visual barrier to a very busy road that was all eliminated in after the fact. So the jury could have concluded that some or all of the severance damages were for the loss of the trees and the loss of the custom landscaping and the significant impact that the taking had upon her particular piece of property that was even greater than the amount testified to by the appraisers and by both sides, frankly. I mean, both sides submitted evidence and testimony from their appraisers. But the jury could have easily concluded, if I live in that property, I'm subjected to this loss of trees and this loss of landscaping, and now I got a giant wooden fence in my backyard, whereas before I had a waterfall feature and all these other things. They could have decided whatever they want based upon that statute. That's their right under the statute to reassess the damages de novo and issue their own award of damages.
So you're saying it wouldn't be clear error for the jury to exceed the amount identified as damages provided by the respondent?
I suppose if it got completely unreasonable and they awarded $1 million and the house is only worth $200,000, then that would probably be a clear error. But we're talking a distinction between Ms. Lackholt's appraisal of just a few hundred dollars. I don't think that that would constitute clear error. And I think that the statute does allow them to fashion their own award of damages. So it clearly states that right in the statute. So, yes, I suppose at some level a jury award could be clear error. Like I said, if the damage determination is more than the entire property is worth and it's not a total acquisition, then that would be an error. But I don't think in this case it reaches that level. We can't conclude that the district court abused its discretion in allowing the post-date. Based upon...
When you say a few hundred dollars, aren't we talking about a few thousand dollars, though, the difference between what your appraiser offered and what the jury found?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't remember the exact distinction between the two on the issue on severance, on just the line item of the severance damages that were related to the loss of the trees.
I was referring to the county's argument that your appraisal calculated construction-related interference damages of $18,200 and the jury awarded severance damages of $25,300.
Did you say the construction-related interference damages, or
yes,
or the there was also a percentage in the appraisal for the loss of the trees and the landscaping, and also for the taking of the permanent and temporary easements. And like I said, I'm sorry, I don't remember that breakdown right off the top of my head.
So. But would your argument be the same if we're talking thousands as opposed to hundreds?
I suppose it depends upon what the spread is when you're talking about thousands. 5,000, 3,000, 50,000, then you're, I think as the spread gets bigger, then the more the risk there is for an error. But I don't think in this case we're talking about a spread that's that significant, given the impacts that, and all the evidence that was submitted. So, but I think there was sufficient evidence submitted by both sides on this case to address this issue, or to support the jury's verdict. I think that's what, you know, the judge said, the district court said in this particular case. Clearly she said it. The quote was read by the court that there was sufficient evidence submitted by both parties, including the county, to support the award of damages. So I think on that basis alone, you know, Ms. Lackholt would request that the court affirm the decision denying the county's post-trial motion.
Mr. Murphy, what is your best direct answer to the point Mr. Sheridan makes that the Anda case has changed the landscape? The primary point he was pointing to is the valuation date. So in the Strom case, you had a pre-valuation date information regarding the construction interference, and to talk specifically, the date of taking is the valuation date. Do you agree that's changed the landscape, and if so, how, and how do you differ from the county's position?
I don't think it changed the landscape. I think really all that case did was clarify in quick take cases that the date of valuation is the date of taking in cases in which the governmental authority uses a quick take procedure. ANDA did not overrule Strom. And if you look at ANDA, I don't understand how the county can even make this argument with a straight face that Almore and ANDA stand for the proposition that post-data taking evidence is inadmissible. In ANDA, the only thing that was excluded was the cost of remediation for the contamination that was discovered after the data taking. The court allowed both the evidence of contamination and the evidence that the property was remediated because they said there may be some stigma associated with a remediated property. So the property owner doesn't get to come up and say, the property was clean when it was taken. You can still present that evidence, the county or the government can still present the evidence that's discovered clearly after the data taking that there was contamination on the property and that the property was remediated because a reasonable buyer might look at it having some sort of stigma. They only excluded the actual remediation cost because of the risk. Justice Anderson was worried about the risk of a double taking, both from the fact that you're taking the property and so you're forcing them, and then also a double taking because if you introduce remediation costs, that's going to decrease what the property owner gets paid. So to protect the constitutional safeguard of just compensation, the Supreme Court concluded that we're not going to allow the remediation costs, but we're going to allow those other two pieces of evidence that's not even known on the data taking but later discovered, whereas in construction-related interference, it's known in a partial taking case on the data taking, any reasonable buyer is going to know if the government's got a two-year temporary construction easement, they can come onto my property at any time during those 2 years, do whatever they want to complete their project. That's a known certainty that construction-related interference is going to occur. So I don't see how ANDA changes that in any respect. Even in Almore, which they also cite in support of their argument, Almore says evidence after the data taking is admissible, but it's whether or not it's certain or imminent or reasonably probable. Those are the standards that are applied in Almore. In Almore, they said there's sort of this merely promissory idea of access being granted to the property owner in the after condition. And what the Supreme Court concluded was because it was merely promissory and not reasonably certain to occur, we're not going to allow that evidence in. We're not going to allow that evidence in to determine fair market value and just compensation. But if the damages are reasonably, you know, are reasonably probable, certain, imminent, factors of certainty, those are the sorts of words that they used in Almore, then they're going to allow that evidence in to determine just compensation and fair market value. And I think Almore couldn't be any more clear. I think both Almore and ANDA support, not only don't support the county's position, it cuts the county's position at the knees because they both talk about that sort of thing. And the county cites the Northwest Airlines case. But if you look at Justice Crippen's dissent in the Northwest Airlines case, it proves that under Almore, evidence of damages that occur after the data taking is admissible. He stated, quote, "The Almore rule of law is complemented by the holding that evidence of future events is inadmissible unless the occurrence of the event is shown to be reasonably probable." Like I said, construction-related interference is not only reasonably probable, it's a known certainty to occur. The county's already said, we're taking a temporary construction easement. Here are our plans. Here's our, you know, here's what we're going to be doing on your property. We're going to be grading. We're going to be tearing out the old road. We're going to be putting in a new fence. We're going to be tearing down your custom landscaping and your trees. All that is known on the date of taking. So all we're asking for to protect the fundamental right to just compensation is to say, hey, after the fact, this is what we, you know, on the date of taking, we knew this was going to occur. Reasonable buyer would factor that into what they would pay for that particular piece of property. Allow us to submit pictures, evidence, testimony of what actually did occur on that piece of property. Because at that point, it's no longer speculative. It's known what happened. In this case, it was known what happened on my client's particular piece of property. And that's, I think, both what Anda and Elmore both stand for that same proposition. And so, I mean, I think if you look at Anda and Strom, and really the strong language in Anda from the Supreme Court about protecting a property owner's right to just compensation, this has to be, this evidence has to be admitted. And I think absent something, pointing to something from the Supreme Court indicating that this whole Anda or Strom and its progeny of cases have all been overruled, I don't think this court can make that decision that this evidence is inadmissible. I mean, it goes from all the way back as the Youngquist v. Wheeler case in 1930 all the way up through Elbert, which was recently decided this spring by this court, that this evidence of construction-related interference is admissible. And I just don't see how there's any basis for the county's argument. So I think either this court can dispose of this two ways. Either the fact that the district court did not abuse its discretion in allowing this evidence in, and I think it could just follow the holding in Strom and Anda and all those other cases and conclude that because construction-related interference is a known certainty on the date of taking, any competent or relevant evidence in regards to that would be admissible. So we would ask that that this court affirm the district court's denial of the post-trial motion. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, if you wish, you would have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. First of all, if you look at what happened in this case, what the owners wanted to do from the outset was to delay the commission hearings until after the construction was done. That was their position from the very outset. That's why we had to go to the district court to seek an order to have the commission hearings before the construction was completed, and why we had to, and why we brought the motion in limine. So if the certainty that counsel describes is so certain as of the date of taking as to what the construction interference evidence is going to be, if it's so certain, why did they have to wait until the construction is done to put the evidence in? So I would argue that it's not certain. Sure, we know that in a road project that the county is going to build, they're going to build on the existing right-of-way, and they're going to build within certain areas that are required, a permanent easement, a temporary construction easement. That's going to happen. But that we don't know the specifics, and that's what comes in, and this is what we're trying to avoid, is that you have the testimony and the pictures of what's going on during the construction, none of which is known specific, the specifics of that, none of which is known on the date of valuation. And Elmore and Anda, despite Mr. Morphy's attempts to muddy the waters on that, are clear that the date of valuation matters, and the date of valuation is the cutoff for knowledge of items that are going to come in as evidence.
Can you address the argument as to harmless error? In particularly the prejudice issue that you have to establish that there was a reasonable likelihood that the district court's error affected the jury's verdict.
I will, Your Honor, and I'm just going to use the numbers that were part of the case. So
I think I understated when I gave the numbers the disparity okay. that you're arguing for. I think you're
sure.
arguing more
so
for $11,000.
The county's this is from Exhibit 10. This is page 114 of Exhibit 10, which was the county's appraisal. Our total indication of damages was $16,750. That broke down. You had $1,000 that was for the land take and the actual value of the permanent easement. You had $400 of some non-replaceable improvements, damages to improvements that couldn't be replaced. There was $1,525 for the temporary easement, which was calculated by the rental value method, which is how that's normally done. And then there was cost to cure damages of $13,825. So the total damages were $16,750. There were actually no stated, quote, severance damages in the county's appraisal. It was all cost to cure damages and the value of the land and the temporary easement. That's what the county's appraiser testified to. Now, the owner's appraisal, their damages were $2,119 for the land taken and $1,600 for the temporary easement, but their severance damages were $25,067, which was attributable to the loss of screening and the loss of the trees and the buffer between the property and the road. And then they had $18,230 of damages for construction-related interference. So if you just accept the district court's position that the jury believed the county's numbers, the most that you could claim would be $13,825 in the cost to cure. So let's just say the jury thought the cost to cure of $13,825 was really severance damages, and said we're gonna adopt the county's number. Well, they still awarded a total of $25,390 in severance damages.
Which is very close to what Meeks said the severance damages were.
That's correct.
So what if they accepted Meeks' severance damages and not the interference damages that Meeks wanted as an add-on?
Well, there still was some extra. I would agree with you.
$300 apart.
About $300, that's correct.
And wouldn't you agree, as respondent pointed out, that the jury had the right to make an independent determination of severance damages?
Well, that's not in the jury instructions. So it may be in the statute, but it was not in the jury instructions. So I don't know if the jury knew that.
So what was the jury told about severance?
Well, they were given a definition of construction interference that basically tracked with Strom that it's a separate item of.
How about severance?
Can be, and severance, they are generally given the before and after rule.
Before and after.
Correct.
And weren't they then allowed to make their own judgment as to before and after?
Yes.
And again, they had an expert that they were only $300 apart from.
Well, if you accept that that's how they did it, but the issue is we don't know how they did it. I mean, we don't know how they came up with their
severance. Well, you never do with a jury. And what you really are having, what you're having to show us that some specific evidence that came to that jury prejudiced that result.
Well, I would simply say that their severance damage claim, their construction interference claim, excuse me, of $18,000 was 42% of their claim.
Well,
so, I mean, that's a significant
sure. And,
amount
and if the
claiming.
Jury had awarded as severance the 25 plus 18, then you probably would have a pretty good argument that they took the expert's $18,000 worth of interference, but they didn't.
Well, Your Honor, I could argue that they didn't take any of the county's award because the county's damages were not characterized as severance damages. They were characterized as cost to cure. And so I could argue that the entire $25,000 came from the owner's appraisal.
Counsel, what did the commissioner's award in this case?
I don't know the answer to
35-7.
That. 35-7.
So, I mean, the jury is well below what the commissioner's.
Right.
Difficulty I have with your argument, your time's expired, but if I can,
sure.
It seems that you're arguing that the jury could have considered inappropriate evidence in its conclusion, but the burden on you, if I'm not mistaken, is you have to demonstrate on appeal that there's a reasonable likelihood that the jury did that. Am I correct about the standard of review?
I believe you are correct, Your Honor, and I would just simply point to the fact that, as I've argued, that if you accept that all of the county's damages, there's still an $11,000 difference between what was awarded and what the county's number was.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your comments today and your briefing. We will take the matter under advisement. Have a good day.
Thank you.